Today on our show, we're interviewing Joy Castro, who is an associate professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln in the Department of English and the Institute of Ethnic Studies. Castro's first book, The Truth Book, a memoir, was named a BookSense Notable Book by the American Booksellers Association. And her novel, Hell or High Water, was a National Latino Book Club selection. Her latest collection of essays is The Island of Bones. Welcome to our show, Joy.
Thank you.
We're going to talk first about Island of Bones. Your new collection of essays just came out this year. The book begins with the anthologies don't mention us, and this is probably a good place to start. What do you mean, the anthologies don't mention us?
Well, that essay, the title essay of the book, was originally invited by Lorraine Lopez and Blas Falconer for their collection, The Other Latino, that looked at voices from different Latino groups that often hadn't received a lot of popular recognition. And my particular background is Cuban-American, mm-hmm. and my family lived on the island of Key West starting in about 1870. So they were working class Cuban-Americans for a long time, long before the bridges were built. and their history was largely erased after 1959 and Castro's revolution, because then the picture in the public mind of who Cuban-Americans were became dominated, understandably, by the waves of exiles who came to the U.S. and to Florida after that time, after 59 and after. So, you know, most of the, like, Latino literature, anthologies and so on, don't really talk about that mm-hmm. older history. And so that was the story that I wanted to tell, the story of my family and my parents and grandparents and so on.
And there seems also to be a very deep cultural misunderstanding of who the Cubans are. I would imagine, like, we tend to think of them as Republican. We tend to think of them as very conservative. We tend to think of them as Catholic. And your family's none of those.
Yes, that's true. Although now, of course, that's changing as well, just even among the Cuban-American community in Miami who were the exiles and the children and grandchildren, because that's just shifting and changing so rapidly as more generations grow up in the United States. You know.
And you actually have a background, a Jehovah's Witness background, which brought you to England. You spent a lot of time in England when you were a kid. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So my grandmother, my Cuban-American grandmother, Virginia Castro, was converted from Catholicism to Jehovah's Witnesses by somebody who went to her door, you know, knocking on her door. And, you know, to her, it sounded pretty good.
She didn't have a sign on the door that says, Somos Católicas?
No, or if she did, they ignored it. And, yeah, so she converted, and she took all her children to the Kingdom Hall. And so my father, you know, was a Jehovah's Witness as a young man, a teenager, giving talks at the Kingdom Hall and so on. And my aunt Letty, she married an elder in the Jehovah's Witness congregation and so on. And my parents got married in the Kingdom Hall in Key West. So yeah, that's what I grew up as, and that's what I knew. Now that wasn't what took us to England.
What took us
to England was actually my father's job. He worked for National Airlines. I don't know if your listeners will remember National Airlines, but
I remember.
Yeah, he started as the guy who would wheel the wheelchair people to the airplane and help them up the stairs back when there were always stairs.
Oh wow.
And he kept, like, slowly climbing up the ladder in Miami. And then when they wanted to open an office in London, they sent him as one of the people there that was opening that office. So we were there for 4 years when I was very small.
So your background as a Cuban-American growing up Jehovah's Witness and living in England when you were a child, I suppose... How does that figure into your work?
Yeah, it's kind of a trippy combination and definitely unusual, I guess. And how does it figure into my work? Well, I guess the themes of displacement, confusion, bewilderment, exile, those are all very familiar to me, and they crop up again and again. And trying to figure out where you do fit, what community is your community, how you can have a voice, all those things seem to run through a lot of the work that I do, fiction and nonfiction, figuring out a sense of home, a sense of belonging, mm-hmm. who your family is.
Would you say then in a certain way, that was a kind of that kind of psychology led you to create a character like Nola in your latest novel?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, she's a Cuban American young woman living in New Orleans, where there's not, at the time that she was growing up, not a big Cuban American community. She's poor. She's growing up in the projects, and then she grows up and she tries to kind of pass for middle class and find a profession for herself and so on. Mm. Yeah, I think so. I think there's some of me and Nola, for sure.
And it seems that Nola doesn't like what she finds.
A lot of friction, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And is that, in a way, there's some kind of parallel? Because there's always some kind of parallel in what we write and who we are. But, you know, of course, there are different things.
Sure.
You know, it's not autobiography.
Right.
When you look back in your journey to discovery and you use that for your writing, are you sometimes disturbed by what you write or surprised and think, oh, my God, I wrote that?
Yes. Yes, that is true. I am. Sometimes I think if you really write in that place of receptivity or negative capability, sometimes you tap into things that you didn't know you knew. And it can be alarming. It can seem almost like prescience sometimes. Yeah, and so sometimes that has frightened me a little bit, surprised me definitely. It's a strange experience.
We're talking to Joy Castro, who came out with two books this year, Island of Bones, which is a collection of essays, and Hell or High Water, which is a mystery, a thriller set in New Orleans. And you mentioned earlier The Other Latino, which is an anthology edited by Lorraine Lopez and Blas Falconer. And I think the general idea behind that anthology was that there are many Latino writers, including you, who are being published today that don't really fit the mold or the stereotype of what it is to be a Latino writer. And you say in Island of Bones that when you call yourself a Latina, it's a shortcut. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure, absolutely. Well, one of the things that Island of Bones explains is that I was adopted at birth, mm-hmm. and the lawyer who facilitated the adoption promised my parents that I was Latina, and like he said, probably Cuban-American like you. Like, what's that? I don't know, but that's what he told them, and so that's what they told me. I always grew up knowing I was adopted, but I always grew up knowing that that was also my heritage, and that was my inheritance, my family. I was, you know. And then when I was 26, I did find, after a few years of searching, my biological mother, and I found out that that was not true at all, and that my biological inheritance includes no Latino blood, if you will, none. So it was super confusing for a while, you know. And also it was complicated. All this was complicated by the fact that my father had deeply, deeply bought into the American dream.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was one of those guys, I will work my way up. I won't care when they laugh at me. I will master English. I will blah, blah. I won't. And he didn't use Spanish in our home. And mm-hmm. we were allowed to take it in school, but he wouldn't speak Spanish with us. He wouldn't do it because he had experienced like some police brutality in Miami mm-hmm. as a young man and so on. So that's not an uncommon story, but it's perhaps not the most common story. And so the issue of identity as a Latina was confusing and complicated for me and for my brother. And so that's kind of what I have come to. But I try to be really transparent and clear with people in case there are any identity police, you know?
No, right. And that's honest, because you don't want to misrepresent yourself.
Exactly.
Because if you do misrepresent yourself, then your writing isn't going to have any credibility with people.
Right, and you're not going to have any credibility with yourself.
With yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it really brings the issue of identity to the forefront. I mean, what really is it to be a Latino, a Latina? Is it the experience, or is it, you know, is it the blood? You know, you have the essay, What My Mother Told Me When I Found Her.
Yeah.
You have it all italicized, but it's also a part of the memoir of the Truth book. Mm-hmm. And so this particular essay is really powerful. It's about being pregnant and being unwanted and being poor and being homeless and all this. And I kind of compare this also to that other essay where you talk about being dirt poor in San Antonio with a child and a partner who made, $600 a month?
Yeah.
And these struggles that you went through, when you look back on them now, how do they figure into your emotional makeup? I mean, do you look at them nostalgically, or do you look at them as representative of how tough it can be for young people, young Latinos, young families?
You know, I don't feel particularly nostalgic.
Sentimental poverty, huh?
No, not at all. I mean, it can be grinding. It can be grueling. And there's a lot of, when you're a parent and you don't have the money to take your child to the doctor, that's just a constant anxiety. Or when you live in a place that is unsafe and you know it, that's a constant grinding sort of wear and tear on your psyche. And I think living in that condition just allied me with millions of people all over the world who are living that way and raising their children. You know, you're so invested in your children. You love your children so passionately.
Right.
And to not quite be able to protect them or give them what they need, that's just a horrible thing.
You know, Joy, given your circumstances and your struggles, you certainly are something of an overachiever. and you got your PhD at Texas A&M.
Yes.
And you got it in literature, Latino studies?
No, modernist literature.
Modernist literature.
Yeah.
So you're getting a PhD. You're not in an MFA program.
Mm-mm.
And you're writing novels. And I assume then you're also publishing in your own field because you're a professor. Do they accept your novels as part of your, accept that as a legitimate publication?
That is such a multifaceted question and so interesting. Yeah, and again, it has to do with communities, right? Which communities accept which kinds of voices.
Right.
Certainly, I was not writing novels when I was in graduate school. I wrote creatively, which I did. They were very, very short pieces. I wrote them as a kind of secret vice and was publishing them and then started publishing articles in my field, the field of modernist literature. Mm. And I did that for several years after I got my first job, my first teaching job. And then I just kept moving more and more into creative writing and being more attracted and thought, okay, I do this better than I do scholarship.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And now, the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, where I work, I was nervous when I published Hell or High Water because it participates in a lot of genre conventions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of the thriller, and I keep saying literary thriller, but
right.
But you know, it's a thriller. It's sort of noir. It's a mystery, and so you know, a strictly literary novel, whatever that precisely is, would have been completely fine with my colleagues. But I was nervous about how a novel that's participating in a genre would be accepted. But they have been great, and they do see it as legitimate work, and so I have exhaled. They still speak to me in the hall. And
they probably actually value you very much there at the university.
They are being great to me. They're being really, really wonderful to me. So.
I remember when I had my first novel come out, and I think Ben had a very similar experience. We were in an English department at the time, and it was majority scholars and majority Ben and I were the only Latinos, and my novel came out with Simon & Schuster with the imprint when it went into paperback, it was supposed to go into Pocket Books.
Mm.
It ended up going into Washington Square Press, but they said Pocket Books, and when my chair announced it to the other faculty members, one of them came up to me and goes, oh, that's the one that does those detective novels, right? That pop fiction stuff. Completely negating it.
Yeah, there is an astonishing amount of jockeying that goes on in an academic environment.
But your novel, Hell or High Water, it seems to me, even though it's very plot-heavy, plot emerges, and even though it's, it just seems that you're the kind of writer, thriller or essay, where you're completely willing to follow the language and let the language take you into the landscape.
That is very kind, and it means a lot coming from a writer like you, so thank you. Yeah, I get lost. The language just drags me around. I just follow.
When you wrote Hell or High Water, did you need to know who your character was before you could actually then write the novel, or did the character emerge as you were writing?
You know, no one has asked me that, but that's such a perceptive question, because Nola was, for me, in the first couple of drafts, still kind of a cipher. I knew what she had to do in terms of the plot, and I knew what her backstory was and so on, but I couldn't quite get her. And she finally came, I don't know how to explain, you know, like she emerged, she became real to me like on the third or fourth draft when I finally got her voice. And it was like, aha, there you are. Yeah, now I can hear you talking. You know, before I sort of was manipulating you. Now you're manipulating me, and that's much better.
I think that's true. I think until you find the character, at least for me, I always create characters. And I don't, for instance, my plots in my work are almost, I don't want to say extraneous because it says that nothing happens. But I'm really just really into creating characters and exploring their psyches. And that's what I do with my stories and with my novels. I know that something has to happen, but I just have to know my character, and only then can I write.
It's like the old equation: plot equals character over time.
Yeah, and you know, in my short fiction, that was always my process. I would just listen, and when a character's voice started kind of speaking to me, then I would follow it wherever it went or didn't go. And you know, being influenced by modernist literature, I think it's a completely legitimate story to have somebody go for a walk and have an epiphany and that's the end, right?
Right.
So, but when I decided I was going to write a novel that was a thriller, I thought, okay, there has to be a plot. It has to come to some, you know, I have to like work backwards from the ending to figure out how the puzzle will go together. So it was this weird new process for me of making characters do things. And so it was a strange, uncomfortable process until they began to kind of, you know, speak.
So you didn't have any issues with the plot. In other words, you already knew the ending and what was going to happen.
Yeah, I worked it out like a mathematical formula in advance. You know, I thought, this is what has to happen at the end, and how do I work backwards from there? Yeah.
I do that in this one way. Before I even write anything about the novel, this is all in my head. I have the first line and the last line.
Yeah.
And I know that I'm working towards that last line.
Yeah, and the journey is what matters, right? The destination is there, but then the journey along the way is full of surprises.
Yes.
And which is harder to write for you, essays or novels?
I think that the thing that is harder to write for me is the thing, well, and it depends on how you define harder, the thing that has an agenda, that knows what it wants to be in advance. So, like, the novel was hard and uncomfortable because I knew what I wanted it to be. I knew what it was supposed to be. And essays that are more discursive, more argumentative, like a few of the ones that are in Island of Bones that were solicited by editors, like, here we have this topic, say something about it.
Right.
So I knew what I wanted to say, and then I had to make that. I had to make the language conform to that. So for me, that's harder in the sense that it's less comfortable and less beautiful. It's more of a crafted thing. And the pieces, whether they're fiction or nonfiction, that come from that space of radical openness and listening and almost like a trance-like state, those are so much more beautiful, and I love them more. You know, I love that experience because I don't know what's going to happen, and I'm writing into a kind of radical uncertainty. And then if they become beautiful, great, I try to publish them, and if they're awful, then they, you know, never get shown to anyone. But, you know, those are the ones that grow me. They really grow me.
And is that because they hurt more?
They do hurt. And, you know, they, because they are greater, they're risks for the author's psyche, I think, in a way that something that you have planned is not a risk as much. You know, you might take other kinds of risks with it, but writing into the unknown or a kind of naked space, it can hurt more. You don't know when you start. It can be ecstatic. You just don't know.
You know, because you study modernist literature, you know that that kind of literature often takes a lot of aesthetic risks. But we always forget that there's all kinds of risks that we take as a writer. Only there's an aesthetic risk that you take when you write. And the one that we don't think enough about is that emotional risk, that willingness to be vulnerable because it's the truth and you want to tell the truth.
Right. And for me, if that aspect is not intensely there, then it is harder in some way because it feels more like your craft or your labor or your job rather than this amazing free fall.
We're talking to Joy Castro, who has two books out this year, Island of Bones, Essays, and Hell or High Water, a novel that takes place in post-Katrina New Orleans during a time when the records for sexual predators kind of got lost. And so they were all over the place and nobody knew where to find them. How did you come up with that?
Well, my husband is from New Orleans, and I've been going there with him for the last 20 or so years. And when Katrina happened, his parents evacuated and they came and stayed with us. And so we were following the news very closely. And there happened to be a news item about that unusual situation of, you know, 1,300 registered sex offenders going off the grid. And a great number of them, a few years later, had never been found. They had taken the opportunity to disappear. And so that just was so provocative to me, you know, that they, you know, would shrewdly use this natural disaster to start new lives or perhaps resume old lives for themselves, and what that might mean to the city. So that I just, you know, gave the main character the task of tracking that story down. She's a journalist, and took it from there.
So why you kind of used a character, a journalist, to do the research? Why didn't you write a nonfiction book about this? And why did you choose the novel instead of being that reporter?
Oh, interesting. Well, I wanted more flexibility. I know. I mean, the research that is in the book is all accurate and up-to-date and factual, but I wanted to tell a story, and I wanted to tell my story that I wanted to tell.
Yeah, that's a lot more fun. Joy, thank you so much for joining us for Words on a Wire. We wish you the best success on these two new books. They're both very lovely. And what are you going to do over the summer? You're a writer. What are you going to do? Are you going to write? Are you going to travel? Both?
I'm going to be in New Orleans. I'm going to be writing. And the sequel to Hell or High Water comes out in July, so I'll be working on the
launch. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. I'm excited.
Is this going to be like a series?
We're going to see. The second one is, you know, coming out, and then I might work on the third one, or I don't know. I don't think I'm quite done with the characters yet.
So. Awesome.
Well, good for you. Congratulations.
Thank you. Well, thank you both
so much, Joy, for being on Words on a Wire.
Thank you.